Let me run this by my lawyer is a really helpful phrase to have in your back pocket. LegalShield has been giving legal peace of mind for over 50 years. They connect you to a vetted law firm in your state for an affordable monthly fee. Want an experienced set of eyes on a contract fine print? Or you finally want to get that will done? LegalShield has a dedicated group of lawyers who have your back, no matter what the future brings. Sign up today at LegalShield.com/iHeart. PPLSI does not provide legal representation or advice. See a plan for complete terms.
Welcome to Ruthie's Table 4, a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios.
Hope you're well. Sorry to be familiar, I just am, because I'm here.
They always
look like, what the... He's quite familiar, isn't he?
This is guy. Oh, it's that guy.
Hello, John.
I can't say how many times when arriving in the River Cafe in a taxi, the driver will turn around to me and say, is this the restaurant where Jamie Oliver cooked? The other day, one even informed me that the River Cafe was owned by Jamie, and I thought, why correct him? He is a prodigal son or the brother who knows that when he walks in the door of the restaurant, he is home.
Like the old days.
When was the last time you were here?
I try and get here at least two or three times a year if I'm lucky. And I have to say, it's a bit like therapy, really. See Charles, which always makes me very happy. We normally go through the same old jokes and then crack on to a bit of new news, friends and family, but there's lots of nostalgia, isn't there?
No, well, I think one of the things you always said is that you love the reset of coming back to the River Cafe. It's something you and Begsy always said.
Yeah.
Is you go out into the world and then it's quite nice to get back to your roots and taste a bit of that, get that River Cafe experience again.
It's like being home, which is lovely.
Jamie came to work with us when he was just about 20, I guess, almost 30 years ago. Rose Gray interviewed him for the job and has always said it was love at first sight.
Thank you, Ruthie. Wow. I love that. I remember the first time Rose interviewed me.
Tell me about it.
Well, I had been working at the Neal Street restaurant for a year and a half, and I knew it was time for me to move on. And I just read this book, the first River Cafe book, Blue, and it just like changed everything. It was like, it's like a moment, because just from a design point of view and a feeling point of view and the black and white reportage photos it was like fresh air, and I knew I had to get there. So I phoned up and I came in. I was quite skint, and I had my first suit that was a really cheap suit. Honestly, it was if it had gone near a candle, it would have gone up in flames so quickly. And I turned up in a suit with a terrible tie, because my dad always said, like, make an effort.
Wear a tie first to an impression. Interview.
Yeah. And I remember Theo, who was head chef at the time, and all the chefs looking around just thinking, like, he's in a suit. What's he doing at the River? Because you don't really wear suits at the River
Even
Cafe.
Our customers don't wear suits.
No, I know, so I really stuck out. But we definitely so bonded on, I think ravioli was the place that we kind of connected. And then the rest was history.
But. Yeah. Then did you come straight away?
Yeah, straight away. I couldn't wait. And it was like, it was an amazing time, because, you know, obviously you always look back in with romance, but it was an amazing time in Britain. And the River Cafe was like on fire and had come from, you know, such humble beginnings, but was this extraordinary, unconventional restaurant doing incredible things, run, of course, by you and Ruthie and the amazing team. But, you know, Cool Britannia, the music scene, the fashion scene, the photography scene, the
Labour.
Art scene.
Yeah.
I remember cooking with you for New Labour before they got in and during they got in. And I remember the Millennium Dome as a sketch on a tablecloth. And I remember it as a model that was just a few metres away from the pastry section while making chocolate nemesis. Yeah. And then I remember the real one, and it's sort of... Wow.
What year did you... Do you remember? I was thinking
I was
96.
19, yeah, I was 19 years old when I came here. And I was
so
here.
So that was 98,
I think.
Yeah, maybe 98. Yeah. And
but
then
nice
the
memories.
When did Blair win the election? Was it 97? Mm-hmm. And then, as you said, there was a kind of excitement, a kind of melding also of politics and food and, as you say, culture and excitement. I certainly remember Rose calling me up. I think I was away... Clearly, when you came for your interview in the suit, or I would have remembered it. And she said, you know, Ruthie, this one you're going to love. Oh. This is, you know, this is somebody.
I was so keen. I was so keen, and it felt like a family straight away. And I'd grown up, obviously, in a family restaurant.
I know.
And my last bit of advice from my dad to me was like, just whoever you work for, just treat their business like yours. And you haven't got one job; you've got every job. If the phone rings, pick it up. If your floor needs mopping, mop it. And I remember just sort of coming to the River Cafe, and it actually felt like a family, which is more rare than, it's not that common even now in restaurants. What you and Rose were doing was so untraditional from what the kind of machine teaches. So I felt like I was being liberated.
Well, your friend Ed Baines once said that, you know, when he came to work for us, he said, you know that song, I Did It My Way? Well, you should say we did it our way, and we didn't know what we were doing.
Yeah.
No. But it was. But we just knew that we were doing it our way.
But you were right.
I don't know, right and wrong.
No, because I think what had happened is, I mean, I feel like I can look at it objectively now, but like training's fine, but it's for consistency and you have structure, and it was very male dominant, and which is very testosterone dominant. And to go from that typical training and typical kitchens to you and Rose was the most visceral, emotional, maternal, common sense, logical thing that ever happened to me, ever. And because you were you, I mean, I know you know what has happened here is special, but when you're an outsider coming in, it was like someone had invented a new type of music. I remember the sheer worry of writing a menu at, say, 3:30. For customers coming in at 6, because normally you're trained to do like monthly menus, and here we are doing two a day every day, and I remember just doing the jobs list, and I remember seeing, like, you'd have random people bringing in like overly Caesar mushrooms, and you or Rose would say, "Oh, stop, we'll put them on now," and it's like, "But we just put no now," and like nothing, everything was now, and it was all about freshness. And. And that energy was, I remember thinking about crying for about 3 weeks. Not because of you or the team, but just because of the stress of a new menu twice a day was completely outside of what I knew. But then you get used to it. And I learned what you created was thinkers.
Yeah.
People that could adjust and react to seasons. And everything that was happening in the industry was about protocol and structures and safety. Whereas it was so exciting to have two women as bosses and owners. I think very male-driven kitchens, and I'm not saying this for any effect, like, are quite aggressive, often flooded with drugs, and it was quite scary.
Yeah.
And I knew those kitchens, and I'd worked in London and abroad in things like that. Mm. So it was, you know, even when I come in today, you can see there's this lovely 50-50 balance and that's the holy grail, I think. I mean, I think if you skew one way or the other, you can get issues. But, you know, it's, but the thinking was so different. Yeah.
But I think it also helped us so much having chefs who worked in other kitchens, because neither of us, Rose did a bit with McNally's in New York and a bit with Carluccio. Mm. But somehow I remember the joy of having... Mm. You know, young people who'd actually experienced other kitchens or contributed to us, who taught us, you know.
But the yin and yang of you and Rose was really a precious one as well, because you crossed over in the middle, but you had strengths on other sides, and that was quite interesting to see.
Great partner.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like also having the open kitchen where there was that connection with the customer.
Do you remember we used to answer the telephone and take reservations when maybe it was before your time, but I literally remember.
No, I remember
writing it down. You know, it's a table for four, a table for six. You know, and then going back to kind of stirring the
polenta.
The telephone in my head. But if we go back, because you spoke about your father, and you speak about, you know, the way you grow up, and just even in the first 5 minutes of conversation, he's present and he's telling you, you know, whether it's to wear a tie or to be curious or to treat a restaurant in a certain way. So why don't we maybe begin also a little bit at the beginning with the Oliver household. Yeah. So how many siblings do you have?
I have one sister, Anna.
One sister.
She's a year younger than me.
Yeah. And so when you were growing up, who did the cooking? Was it your mother? Was
Mom,
it your father? She did.
Yeah. I mean, Dad was a trained chef, and he'd started really young and also grew up in a pub that did very good food.
Did he?
Yeah.
His father owned the pub.
Yeah.
So this is third
And they still
generation.
Have the Yeah, they had have a pub called the Plough and Sow in Paglesham, which is in a dead end near the River Blackwater, which is where we used to get sea bass from Ben's Fish.
Yeah. And Ben's Fish.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That is
And West Mersey Oysters.
Yes.
So that's where Dad grew up. And I was born actually in South Ockingdon. South Ockingdon in Grays, Essex. So right in the estuary of Essex and got devastated in the war. And Dad was the youngest license holder in the country at the time.
How old was he? What
I believe he was 17.
No,
I think in those days you could have it a bit younger. Wow. He was at least 18, but I think he was even younger. And then he had me at 20.
Wow.
So as soon as I was born, we got a tatty old pub that was beautiful in a little village called Clavering. Mm. And it was a 16th century pub. And I obviously grew up there. But Dad, I mean, I remember a few things that stuck out. So the chalkboards were daily. So that gave me some sort of connection with the River Cafe changing daily. The game was local. The fish was only on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Mm. Lots of live crabs and lobsters and whole fish, whole animals coming in to be butchered. He had a brigade. I only ever remember a brigade of at least six on a shift. And the pastry was a proper pastry of sort of Anglo-French, Swiss-style desserts.
That's quite ambitious.
Yeah, well, I thought it was normal. But, of course, even now it's
that
not
is,
normal.
No, it isn't.
And, you know, typical would have been freezers full of stuff you could reheat. And
was he trained, Jamie? Was he
He was trained, yeah. And he really, I mean, he didn't go to school much as a child. But he got Student of the Year at Southend College and went and worked in France as well. So he was kind of, he had a really good start. But he ran the pub, and I remember little things like the head chef was paid more than he paid himself. Mm. And I remember as a child going, well, that can't be right. Mm. And he's like, no, we've got to invest in the quality and get the brigade steady. And of course, these are all real things. But it had a bar side and then it had a restaurant side, which meant there was slightly two tones of cooking happening.
Both with food.
Yeah, and quite Anglo-French cooking. So kind of things that you would get, I guess, at the Wolseley or kind of like Rules, you know, classics. Mm. So like Simply Cooked Game and beautiful Dover soles, you know, cooked how you liked it. But everything homemade. So that was, I just wanted to go to London for 5 years so I could learn some things, then come back and run a pub.
I actually remember you kind of very, really quite late. You were always really interested in the pub. Did your mother work there as well?
Yeah. She was a classic landlady in the sense of, that's not like an EastEnders landlady. Yeah. Like, it's quite a glamorous role. And mum was very glamorous. All I remember with my mum, honestly, was she'd get ready for 2 hours, the smell of that hairspray from the gold the gold canister and rollers.
Yeah.
Always in rollers. And then this, and always in sort of like, 90s, and then all of a sudden this outfit came on and the hair was out and then she'd go down about 8:15
perform, maybe she wanted to be in the
2 hours hi Sally, and just and just work in the locals. And it was a busy pub, and I think, I guess in a sort of cheesy sense, we went from a working class family to a classic middle class family in about 13
but
years.
But who did the cooking for you and your sister?
Mum.
Then
yeah,
how would she do that between rolling her hair
she would do all the books, all the Mum would do the hiring and Dad would do the firing, and often Mum had to run after people that Dad had fired to rehire them because he hadn't dealt with the problem quite right. But Mum mainly did like classic things, really, like, you know.
Did you live in the pub?
Yeah.
Upstairs.
Yeah, so like my bedroom was not much bigger than this room, which is like 2.5 by 4. Yeah. Of course, it was 16th century, so there's gaps all around the edges. So everyone smoked such a lot.
Yeah.
So, you know, God forbid I ever do get anything unhealthy with my lungs. But that, if it was, it was because I had passive smoking as a child.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, I mean,
So you lived over. So would you had a dining room and a kitchen, or
not really? There was two bedrooms and a front room. But in the front room, we had a little table. So Mum would cook down in the commercial kitchen in between shifts.
She would cook the dinner for you and your sister.
Yeah. But they cooked well, and Mum still cooks well today, and Dad still cooks well. But they're both retired now, which they did in lockdown.
Yeah. So you can imagine living upstairs from this pub, having your parents, you know, involved
in the
kitchen.
It was a rumble, always a rumble. Was it? Customers and laughter and giggling. But, of course, I worked at the weekends for pocket money.
Yeah. What did you do?
I started up bottling up, which is replacing.
What's that mean?
Well, you go and look at the bar after a busy night, and you look at all the empty shelves, and if you're lucky, you can see little round marks where all the bottles had sat, and you'd count them. And and then you'd replace them, and then you'd recycle the bottles.
How old were you when this was going on?
Nine.
Nine?
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I was in the wash-up by 10. And the wash-up involved a lot of veg prep, so not dissimilar to at the River Cafe when you're picking the herbs and, and all the stuff. And then I really wanted to get into the kitchen, so I was probably fully in the kitchen by about 11. And they had sections, so they had veg, starters, mate, and they split. You'd have someone putting food in the oven, someone taking it out and serving it, and then a pastry section. But yeah, I mean, I'd probably by the time I was 16, I'd done the rotation of the kitchen maybe three times. So I remember having to develop a skill to teaching cooking, as in when I say teaching, like if you had a 21-year-old come in from college to get a job as a commis chef, I'd be 14 and I'd have to train him.
Yeah,
and obviously, when you're 14, you haven't got a hair on your chin, and these 21-year-olds look like men. So I had to sort of develop a way of teaching without getting a slap.
How would you do that?
Make them feel like they were teaching themselves. and like teaching, like, are you left or right-handed? Okay, work from left to right. Okay, so this is this dish, and we prep this and prep that, and we put that on ice, and, you know, just try and set it up for service so the service can flow. And I obviously, being young, I was cocky as well, so I often ended up in the freezer. I often ended up with like
why?
Because I've maybe back chatted.
That would be like somebody put you in the freezer.
In the freezer, yeah,
and close the door
and sit on it. Sounds like The Shining. Minutes. It was a bit like The Shining, if I'm honest. I'm sure it was illegal. I'm sure it was with love. I'd finish shifts and take my jacket off, and there'd be clothes pegs with. Like there'd be like 100 clothes pegs and a few signs saying very unkind things.
Did your father know they were doing this?
Oh yeah, and I think he felt it was a kind of initiation of some description. So of course, by the time I was 18, I was well versed to stuff.
Wow, I do think that might go on now.
I think wherever you have teams and institutionalized sort of training, like, which I think kitchens have been, that there's that going on, and it can be for best or for worst. I think it's you posted something with your team, and it was very clearly a 50-50 split of men and women. I reposted it because it's so powerful.
Yeah, yeah.
The balance is so important in a really happy kitchen, and if it's 100% men, all hell breaks loose. And you know, if you can get to 20%, that's amazing. Yeah. But 50-50 is definitely the highest.
I also think there is a feeling that, I mean, it's something that I've always said, that when people call up and say, a journalist might say, wow, it's so hard being a chef. It's so stressful. And I go, it must be really hard being a journalist. You know, God, it must be so stressful. Because in a way, you want to take our profession and have it not be different from other professions. You know, the kind of myth that because we have to do, you know, service so quickly, or we have difficult customers, or chefs are yelling, that's so old-fashioned in a way. And now, certainly the young people who work in the River Cafe are just not going to put up with that anymore.
But I think
we're over that.
I think as a kid that struggled in school, and as an adult now with kids sort of looking at where AI and technology and all the things that are going to happen around learning and how that's going to affect learning in schools in the future. I think what I can thank you for 1,000 things, but one of the things that is most precious that you and Rose taught me and the institution, the family that you created, was how to think for yourself. So that's really interesting. Because learning stuff is learning stuff, and that's kind of what happens in school.
Yeah.
But problem solving and resilience and reacting to weather, which is therefore seasons, which is therefore ingredients, which is therefore the two shifts a day, that, you know, like, it was really interesting. As a young chef, I would watch brilliant chefs come out of Michelin star kitchens, and they'd go and do their own thing. And they'd be doing versions of the same thing that they left. And if you look at the family tree that's come from the River Cafe, I mean, I guess Sam from Morrow is a really good first example. Like, you can see River Cafe through their heart and their soul, but it's they did this incredible North African
Spanish.
And they not only went into restaurants, they opened pizzerias and sandwich bars, and they just did brilliant things, and you created thinkers. And I think that's different. I always tell people there's sort of two ways to run a kitchen. One is sort of through fear, and one is through family. And family's a bit slower, but you get much more back in return. And fear is very efficient, but you get so little back in the long run. I feel quite passionately about that.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Help helps is a maxim I believe in. We all carry around stress and hardship, and when we keep it inside, it starts to chip away. Therapy is a safe place, and therapy is for everyone. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/Ruthie today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ruthie. BetterHelp.com/Ruthie.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
Carly Cho's was really interesting time for me because it was in the Neal Street restaurant.
Designed by Terence Conrad.
Yeah, and next door to the Neal Street. I mean, the Neal Street was famous for mushrooms and late night serving because of the Opera House. The kitchen was hidden in the basement, so you didn't see much light all day. So I was pretty vitamin D deficient. You know, Antonio was the wonderful character at the front door, smoking a cigar, having a little whiskey or something, but not really in the kitchen. But Gennaro was in the kitchen, and he was an incredible draw, but he didn't work in the restaurant. He worked in the very first Carluccio's deli, driven by Priscilla Carluccio, who was Antonio's wife. And that was really interesting because the kitchens were shared. And I did 9 until 3, and then I did 6 until 1 in the morning.
Every day?
Every day. But then I did a third shift, which was 3 until 7 with Gennaro. So I did a third secret shift.
Is that how many hours? That was like
I was doing like 20 hours.
Yeah, 20
I
mean, hours.
But I was so young, I could do it. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't do it now. But but I was only really there to learn from Gennaro. And, you know, I knew I just had to make bread with Gennaro, really. So I'd asked Antonio, he said no. So I thought, well, look, if I'm here till 1, I can get the ovens on, I can get the temperatures on, I can weigh out all the flours, I can get all the kind of... I kind of configured everything so he could work quicker. And because I thought, poor man, he's getting up at the crack of dawn every day. So, and one of the clever things I did with the bread was all the stale bread from that day, they would... make into very fine breadcrumbs to dust the trays with to get a lovely crunch. And I'd stack about 100 trays up to make all these different breads. And I'd draw little rude messages in there and sort of like say, good morning, Gennaro, and just to befriend him because I didn't know him at that stage. And as soon as we became friends, he said, oh, don't worry about Antonio, just come in. But it was an amazing, I mean, the restaurant was great. It was very traditional, slightly northern Italian stuff. But what happened at night was amazing. Like at 4 o'clock, ding dong, and there'd be 30 policemen that would come in. And
4 in the morning? Yeah, four in the morning. Afternoon.
Yeah, 4 in the morning. Oh. And I get up there, open them up. There's police out here, Gennaro. Let the bastards in. I'm like, oh, okay. Then all these coppers would come in, but clearly it was their home. They sat down as if it was their front room. They went behind the bar. They started making espressos. And we'd reheat the stale bread from the day before. Give them the stale stuff. Reheat it. And then we'd give them some like honey and some jam. And they'd be very happy. And they would, you think I'm making it up. But yeah, it was kind of...
That's Covent Garden, the great British Bobby, or whatever.
I mean, I don't think it's happening anymore. But
that sounds like the good old days.
Yeah, but they were very romantic, and I think Gennaro did give me a good base to tiptoe into the River Cafe. But River Cafe really was where my heart was at.
You know, one of the amazing trajectories was when we did a film called A Christmas at the River Cafe, and that was a film that, you know. Really, I remember, you know, you fried mushrooms, didn't you?
Yeah, well, we did, I think, porchetta and rotolo.
Yeah.
And then I think I was on Hots 2 one Hots, night, yeah. And obviously I can look at it back now, sort of seeing, because you, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, you were filming for a couple of weeks, the show, yeah, that you were making, and I wasn't supposed to be working that night. I don't know if I ever told you this.
No, I don't know that.
So the night that I was in the background of your program, mm, I wasn't supposed to be working. I was off, and my wife, Jules, was off as well, and she worked at the River Cafe on the front of the house. We hadn't had a night off together for ages, and the phone rang about 4 o'clock, and one of the team had gone sick. Jules, you know, with all the best in the world, like, yeah. I had to come and put the shift in.
Yeah.
But that's when the crew was there. And actually, they were kind of in the way, because I was catching my tail, because I was an hour and a half late for the shift to cover someone. And I was running Hots 2, which, as you know, is one of your busier sections. I'm sure it still is now, but it was Frito Misto, Tagliatelle, if I remember, with Girolles and risotto.
Do you remember?
I do remember. And the slow cooked pork, of course. Yeah, I didn't think anything of it. And the night it went out on TV, like many months later, maybe six months later, possibly, I didn't know I was in it because I was working.
Yeah.
But then the phones started to ring the next day, literally the next day.
Well, I came in, I would say that I came in that morning and said, wow, Jamie, you did a really great thing with those mushrooms. You were amazing on television. And then the phone rang, and I can remember where it was. The phone used to hang up on a hook in the kitchen.
Yes.
Just when you came in, it was before we had the really open kitchen. And it was a call for you from Pat Llewellyn.
Yeah.
You came over to me, like, Ruthie, somebody just called me up and asked me if I want to do a screen test. What's a screen test?
Yeah.
Should I go?
I didn't know anything.
And we didn't know anything. And then he said, Ruthie, a newspaper's called up and said, do I want to do a column? Can I go? We went, sure, Jamie. And then a supermarket is called up and said, can I go? And I would say that within a very short time, you had a column in a newspaper, a television show, an advertising campaign with a supermarket, and they knew that you could do all this, and you showed them that you could, and you did.
I mean, when I think about it, I mean, I remember when I had my 20 years anniversary, and there was loads of people together, and to think that it really genuinely does come back to that phone call at 4 o'clock saying, yeah, can you cover?
What was it like from being a chef in the River Cafe? Who was around you? Who was protecting you? Who was guiding you?
Yeah, I didn't really have any protection for a while. Everyone was perfectly lovely, but I'd done the first book, like I couldn't write or type, so I did it in dictaphone. The responsibility of delivering it is like a nightmare. And then
it was The Naked Chef, the first book.
Yeah.
And so
yeah,
that was with the television show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was, it was kind of like a year later, at least. It was, because what happened was they pitched like a little showreel to Channel 4, and it sat with them for like 6 months. And then they passed on it. It then went to BBC Two, and Mark Thompson commissioned it in 7 days. So I think, like, you know, knowing what I do about commissioning now, I think there might have been a gap, and like they probably had a BBC sort of remit for representing a wide group of people, and I was a bit younger, I guess. I'm making this up, by the way. I don't know. I have asked him since, because he runs the New York Times now, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's left the New York Times.
Oh, is he left? And he just said, like, you know, I think he just said, I just had a feeling and I took a call on it. But that doesn't happen that often. I mean, and TV's not as, they're very risk averse. And normally if you're on telly, I mean, had we not come up with The Naked Chef, which is, I remember writing down what I would and wouldn't do on TV. And it said, you know, stripping down restaurant food to its bare essentials. And stripping and bare turned me into The Naked Chef, which was
that was that your title?
Yeah, well, I didn't come up with it. Before that, the working title was Forking Gorgeous. So thank God. I mean, both were looking quite shady, but I think Naked Chef just got away with it.
Yeah.
And probably more than anything, hit a moment and a sound and a time. And again, like, I think timing's an interesting master, isn't it? It was interesting. It was a bit of a whirlwind. I think it felt like being in a pop band. And I think because I was younger and I wasn't married at that point, it was very leery. And thankfully I had Jules, who's obviously I've been with since I was 18 and was, you know, my rock. And I had good friends in the business, and I had you and Rose, and I had mum and dad, so yeah. I felt like safe enough. No, I did the Naked Chef in my holiday time. Yeah, I mean, I think I worked here until the end of season two.
Yeah.
I've still got that Vespa. Do you know it got nicked? And I ended up buying my own Vespa back off eBay. What? Off of a friend of a friend of a criminal. Yeah, I've still got it. Still use it. It just makes a slightly different sound going up the hill than it used to. Slightly more strained.
If you like listening to Ruthie's Table 4, would you please make sure to rate and review the podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
I once saw an interview with, great interview, Michael Parkinson, with George Best and Beckham. And George Best talked about the difference between his vulnerability when he became, you know, a huge figure, and he had no one. There was no one. He went from being a kid kicking a ball to being somebody that was followed by paparazzi and given deals. And yeah. And now when you think, you know, the kind of surround that you have of agents and PR, and it's a very, you know,
I think
what
I did
level.
Quite well, but only through naivety and passion, I guess, is I looked after myself pretty early. I had an agent for a bit, and she was fantastic, but like I knew she had many people, and I knew I was one of many, so I sort of started the production company. We didn't know what we were doing early, employed someone to look after me from like a legal point of view. So I did that. I think that gave me a lot of freedom in the early days. And I think in those early days, you can get eaten out and spat out in about 4 years quite quickly. And luckily, I always sort of say it was like when I set up 15, it was such a beautiful thing and a beautiful premise. So, and they're, well, why did you do it? And I said, well, I wanted to, I could, and I did. And it was as simple as that. I was young enough, stupid enough, and able enough to do it. And obviously the scenario of having a 24-year-old kid, I'd gone from having no money to having like money in the bank, and I spent all of it on 15, which was a charity. So like, my dad was so worried about me, he thought I'd lost the plot because he'd never made an easy pound. Mm. So he was very concerned. And there was about 3 weeks when I was theoretically bankrupt. Yeah. But luckily I got...
Let's talk about 15, because when you say it was a beautiful concept, it was. It wasn't just opening a restaurant. It was a restaurant with values and a kind of philosophy and an idea of fairness. And
yeah.
Tell us about...
Well, it was really, it was kind of like, I think I'd felt from being that kid that struggled at school, like, is there anything that we could do to kids that have gone off the rail, like, or got lost or had problems with the law, and even homeless kids. And so we set up 15 because the profits from the restaurant would take 15 kids every year and train them for like 16 months. And really, it was a very beautiful blend of the values that I'd learned at the River Cafe with you and Rose, mum and dad, and Gennaro. And you could see it. Mm. I mean, it was a very different restaurant, but also you could see the kind of genetics in recipes of the River Cafe and Gennaro and mum and dad. And really, mainly through you guys, we took these kids on trips around sourcing from farmers. And, you know, look, some of these kids were like drug dealers and fraudsters and, you know, and we'd take them to catch wild salmon.
Mm.
And then we'd get a farm salmon and a wild salmon and we'd do an autopsy and show the difference. And like, seeing is believing. And you start to get their wonder. Mm-hmm. And they're like, okay, so you haven't won them over yet, but then you do that with pork and then you do that with foraging and then you do that with olive oil. And slowly but surely, about 9 months in, the consistency, and I think that's one of the things I learned about lots of the things I love and people that we love is... Mm. Consistency, like, of how a person is, how they dress, how they look after their yard or whatever it might be, and their product. I think for these young kids, most of them got in trouble with the law because they had no consistency. Mm. And through 15 and the things that inspired me, we tried to, and we graduated over 80% every year.
Mm.
And for context, that's the complete opposite of the government when they rehabilitate young offenders.
Yeah.
So they do about 25. Yeah. But we did that for 17 years until sadly it closed.
But it also shows, I think, back to food, you know, that what food can do, how food can be, a generator of fairness. So as you were talking about 15 and taking these kids around, I was thinking, well, is there something that could be a catalyst as strong as food to motivate people to taste, to experiment, to commit, to learn? And I think, you know, I think, well, maybe, I mean, would you, as a fat, you know, a tailor trying to teach people to make suits, or you know, a doctor trying to, you know, to get people healthy, all those professions, but there's something about food, which is so compelling.
And I think if you did a broad strokes analysis of all those young people that got in trouble in their life or with the law, like, what's beautiful about cooking is, you know, even on a bad day, there's still, I always see it like little jiffy bubbles, you know, like, it's not just a bad day, like, there's still three or four positive bubbles of something you've learned that day.
Mm.
So, do you know what I mean?
I
think that's what's so nice about cooking. And then at the end of the year, you've got all these bubbles that you've learned. And then it's like, well, okay. So obviously from what we'd learned at the River Cafe, we would sit down and write menus every day.
Mm.
And that was, and still is, rare. But they kind of, the young people would learn about food more from the debate about, oh, should we, could we, is that right, is that wrong? And so that was a very powerful experience for me. And to be honest, until then, I'd never been political. I'd never been a campaigner. I'd never had deep-seated feelings about what was right or wrong about
I think maybe you did. I think you probably did. Don't you? I think you probably did.
I don't feel that...
I mean, politics is politics, but your values and your fairness and...
I think they were there.
Kind of way.
They were there, but I think the idea of having a voice or expressing them or using a platform to amplify stories that had to be told, I don't feel like I'd learned that until 15. And as I got to know their stories, and like, when you talk to young kids about life of crime, it's so frightening and so sad and it's so hopeless. And you kind of get down to sort of nuts and bolts, like, you know, mums and dads that couldn't afford to feed them and how like a free school lunch was important. You know, and like, it was the only hot meal of the day. And you hear it sometimes mentioned, but when you meet it, when you see it, and you might have, like, you know, a lot of our students could handle themselves because they'd been through such traumatic lives, but yet they were still grateful for the hot school lunch and to be that free school lunch kid and the baggage that goes with it. And of course, that I started to realise then, because roughly around the same time, there seemed to be a lot of press around how bad school lunches were. So I kind of then went on to that.
And in the next episode, we're going to talk more about Jamie's school meals campaign. We'll also head back into the kitchen with Jamie to make a classic River Cafe recipe.
The River Cafe Lookbook is now available in bookshops and online. It has over 100 recipes beautifully illustrated with photographs from the renowned photographer Matthew Donaldson. The book has 50 delicious and easy-to-prepare recipes, including a host of River Cafe classics that have been specially adapted for new cooks. The River Cafe Lookbook, recipes for cooks of all ages. Ruthie's Table 4 is a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Managing your diabetes just got easier. The powerful new Dexcom G7 lets you see your glucose numbers on your compatible watch and phone without fingersticks. And because Dexcom G7 is the most accurate CGM system, you can be confident in your food, exercise, and medication decisions. And all those decisions can lead to big results, like more time in range and lower A1C. Get started at Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.